Well, it's nice to be here today, this Sunday. I think it's the last Sunday of the month. And I'm going to talk about me, which is one of my favorite subjects, and why I became a Buddhist. So I was born in Iowa 76 years ago, as a matter of fact, and raised in Phoenix, Arizona, spent some time in Wisconsin, lived in L.A. since 1969. So I was born a Lutheran, and my parents were happy that was the case. But then in the 1960s, I became an agnostic. I thought there might be something out there, but I didn't know how to define it. And my father never forgave me for that, but that's how life goes. And then in 1978, I was about to turn 30. And being a product of the 60s, I realized people who were over 30 died soon. So I thought to myself, I should probably get a religion so I could die well. And I bought Houston Smith's book, World Religions, and read the whole thing. And the chapter on Buddhism made the most sense, sort of secular humanism, you know? And I went to a meditation center to learn how to meditate, which is where I now live. I've been there a really long time. And it was one of the worst experiences I ever had. For some reason, they didn't want to turn on the heat. So it was cold and it was rainy. And they gave me this little cushion to sit on and said, the teacher will be down in an hour and a half. And I thought to myself, this is going to be the longest hour and a half of my life. And it was. It was just terrible. My knees hurt, my back hurt, my mind was agitated. I thought to myself, how could anybody do this and appreciate the outcome? It's just complete suffering. But then I remember in the chapter that Buddhism is only about two things. Buddhism is about suffering and the end of suffering. So they were teaching me that life is ultimately unsatisfactory, especially on the floor. And then Shinzen came down. Now, Shinzen was an American monk who had been going to UCLA studying Japanese culture and language and decided to go to Japan for advanced studies. And he became a Shingon monk. And he came back to the United States and started to live at the meditation center and eventually became the vice abbot of the meditation center. And as I think back, I am so lucky that he was really my first teacher, because English was his first language. It's my only language. And he could be eloquent in his description of reality after meditation and being a Buddhist. And I thought to myself, I want to see the world the way he does, because it is so cool the way he sees the world, never realizing how much effort and time it would take. Well, I continued to meditate. I continued to show up. And then I wanted to be a Buddhist. And there's a ceremony to be a Buddhist. It's called the Five Precepts and the Three Refuges. And they give you a Buddhist name. Five precepts are, I will practice not to take life. I will practice not to take what is not given. I will practice not to indulge in sexual misconduct. I will practice not to speak unskillfully. I will practice not to consume intoxicants, which at 30 was probably the hardest one of the five. And then you take refuge in the Buddha, refuge in the Dharma, his teachings, and refuge in the Sangha, the followers of the Buddha who are ordained. And then they give you a name. And I was given the name Kusala, K-U-S-A-L-A, and was told that Kusala means skillful and wholesome. And I thought to myself, they already recognize that in me. And then they said, we're giving you that name because you aren't. And every time somebody says kusala, it's to remind you of the direction you need to go. Okay, I bought that. I tried hard. I practiced the five precepts. And then in 1994, I decided to become ordained as a Buddhist monk, not really knowing what that all meant. But at the meditation center, they said, if you get ordained, we'll give you a room to live in. We'll give you a stipend so you can buy food and underwear. And we'll give you health insurance in case you get sick and you don't have to die then. And I thought to myself, wow, what a great deal this is. And then you'll be made the residential manager and you'll have other other things to do as well. One of them is you need to feed the animals. We have birds and we have fish and we have dogs and we have cats. You need to feed them every day, but only for a while. Now, 25 years later, still feeding the dogs, still feeding the cats. And I thought, okay, this is a way to sort of wind down and get out of business world and sort of see what it means to be you. Well, it all changed. 1997, I was at Cal Poly Pomona. I was giving a talk to the Buddhist club, and there was a reporter and photographer there from the LA Times. And they wanted to take a picture, and they wanted to write a story about the Buddhist club and what I had to say, but basically about the Buddhist club. And then, to my surprise, it ended up in the LA Times, a picture of me in the LA Times. I thought, wow, this is so cool. I've really made it, haven't I? And then my whole life changed because people saw that article. And Deacon Szymanski at LA County State Prison for Men in Lancaster, California, said to me over the phone, Kusala, we saw the article. Would you like to come up to the prison and speak to the prisoners? And I said, there are Buddhists in prison? I couldn't figure out how they got there, if they were following the five precepts. And so I made that commitment. I said, I'll come up and talk. And it was like once a month. And at that time, I only had a motorcycle. I didn't have a car. And going to Lancaster in the summer and the winter is like going right into hell. And the wind never stops blowing. But I continued, and I found other people to support me and help me. And after a year, I got another phone call. Kusala, we saw your picture in the paper. Would you like to come to LA County Juvenile Hall in downtown Los Angeles and speak to the young people about Buddhism? I said, do you have any Buddhists there? And he said, no, we haven't found any, but they're all suffering here, and I think they would appreciate what you have to say. So for 5 years, I ended up going to Juvenile Hall and had some really good experiences. One of the things that took me a while to adjust to was the fact that there were a lot of other religious volunteers there, and I was like the only Buddhist guy. And I met a Catholic volunteer on the way to one of the dormitories, and he said, how are you? What religion do you practice? I said, oh, I'm a Buddhist, proudly. He said, are there any Buddhists here? I said, you know what, I haven't found any yet. He says, well, why are you here? I said, because people are suffering. He said, me too. So we had that in common. We had something in common immediately. We were there for a reason. We wanted to make their life better at whatever level we could do that. I won the probation department of Volunteer of the Year award, and I thought to myself, wow, this is so cool. I'm a volunteer. They always like you when you're free. And I succeeded in doing nothing. Because people would say, well, what did you do? I said, well, I showed up. Did you save anybody? Well, I showed up. Did anybody find what you had to say interesting? Well, I showed up. It turned out to be that. If you show up and keep showing up, you can make a difference. You'll never know the difference you make, because nobody's going to tell you, but you're making a difference. During that time, I got a call from the mayor of Garden Grove. He said, we're having a mayor's prayer breakfast, and we'd like you to be the keynote speaker. We saw your picture in the paper. I said, okay. I said, well, you know, I don't pray, but I do eat breakfast. Is that okay? He said, that's fine. It's okay. So I gave my talk, my keynote presentation, and then I got a call from the secretary and of the police department saying, would you like to be a volunteer police chaplain in Garden Grove? And you could ride along in the police cars and you could help people that are suffering. And I thought to myself, you know what? Cops was always one of my favorite shows. So this is a perfect introduction to what it really means to be a cop. So for 7 years, I did that. And I got some certificates thanking me for it. And see, you don't get any money, but you get a lot of certificates, which is really cool. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm learning a whole lot about stuff. And in the beginning, I only wanted to be a Buddhist because I wanted to see the world differently. And now that I'm doing Buddhism, I'm seeing me differently. I'm seeing how a human being can evolve using their religious perspective. And I hadn't taken that in consideration. I just wanted to die well. That was the only reason I wanted to be a Buddhist. And then I was at UCLA for 12 years. I was university religious conference. We had a Buddhist club. I went over to the medical center and gave talks to the chaplains on Buddhist patient care and end-of-life issues, and had a wonderful time being on campus and meeting a whole lot of folks that were much smarter than I was. And it just made such a big difference in how I looked at myself and what I did in the world just because I got ordained, just because I decided to drop out of the workforce and work on me. Now, you might be wondering, well, what the heck is Buddhism? And I find Buddhism is pretty easy to understand. We've got the five precepts, and then we have the three aspects of Buddhist wisdom, which are really good. Anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, suffering, and not self. Well, number one, impermanence. Everything changes all the time. Sometimes it changes for the better. Most of the time it doesn't. But it's going to keep changing. And the Buddha warned us, don't get attached. Don't cling. Because you're going to suffer even more when it changes. Can you have an open hand and let reality and the situations you find yourself in come to the open hand and be taken away? And now that I'm aging, and looking at 80 as a realistic destination, I think to myself, yeah, man, it's all changing. And when you start getting older, it changes even faster. And I thought to myself, you know what? I got to change the way I perceive the world around me just because I'm getting old. I got to wake up in the morning and say, this is going to be the best day I'm ever going to have. And the reality is, it's true. Because it's only going to get worse. So we need to enjoy it while we got it, because one day we won't have it. And you know, the legs start to go, you get irritated easily, or you forget what you thought you were going to do, and you have to remind yourself. And you have all these things, and sometimes food doesn't taste very good, you know, and you wonder about the taste buds, am I losing my taste? And then you have the chocolate pudding, and you realize it's okay. And so impermanence really meant a lot to me, because I can see it every day in my life. And then the idea of dukkha, which is life is ultimately unsatisfactory. Now, this is a tough one, because we're taught that life has the potential of being wonderful. And all you need is the right shoes, or the right guitar, or the right house, or the right car, and you will have a wonderful life. And we just had Black Friday. And a lot of people were trying to have a better life and save some money doing it. And it doesn't work that way. Because ultimately, you will find that life is going to be unsatisfactory. Because it's never the way it's supposed to be. It's just the way it is. And if you're set on making and having a wonderful meal during Thanksgiving, and it turns out not to be wonderful, well, the Buddhist would say, what did you expect? It's never going to be as good as you thought it was going to be. And they overcharged you on top of that. Come on. Where's your equanimity? Where's your balance? Where's your peace in all these different situations? And then the last one, which is my favorite, is not self. Now, get ready for this. The Buddha said, we don't have a soul. Now, I came from Iowa. Everybody in Iowa has a soul. And now I'm a Buddhist in LA, and I'm hearing that I don't have a soul. And I'm going, whoa. But it's been updated for 2025. No longer don't we have a soul. Instead, we don't have a self. You do not exist the way you think you do. You are a figment of your imagination. Whoa. It's the biggest and best hallucination you're ever going to have, this person standing in front of the mirror, because it's not you. Well, why would that be the case? Why would the Buddha want to say it's not you? Number one, you're going to have to die. Everybody dies. Nobody likes to think about it. When you go to church, all they do is tell you how to live. But very rarely do you hear how to die. Live well, die well. Who dies the best? Nobody. No self. Nobody is no self. If you can figure out how you don't exist, it won't matter when you don't exist, because it's not you. So you might say, well, I heard Buddhism has reincarnation. No, it doesn't. Buddhism has rebirth, because reincarnation requires a soul. So we have rebirth. And then you might say, well, what's being reborn? Well, it's karmic energy. All that you've said and done and thought in this lifetime is your karma. And all that has a consequence. And think of it as a wake behind the boat. And you're just a karmic transformer, transforming all the speech, action, and thought into energy. And the energy doesn't die. Even Einstein said that. That it doesn't die. It continues into the next lifetime. Some people have a good past life. They end up in Palos Verdes. Some people, not so much, Koreatown. Okay. But that's only where you start, because your karmic energy is creating energy all day, every day, even at night, by what you think, say, and do. You're in charge. You are in charge of having a better life by thinking in a skillful way, by speaking in a skillful way, by acting in a skillful way, reducing suffering initially and ending suffering eventually. It's an amazing idea that they had. Now, I have never felt that I've lived before. This seems like the very first time. And I'm not sure what's going to happen after this time is over. But you know what? It's nice to have a couple thoughts to take with you. Buddhism says the only thing you can take with you in death is your karma. Nobody can take their golf clubs. Nobody can take their car. Nobody can take their dog. It's just your karma and you. And then how do you die well? Is there a practice in dying well? Yeah, there is. It's called meditation. And why we meditate is we practice sitting down for 20 minutes and letting go of everything for 20 minutes. No TV. No snacks, just sitting there quietly, meditating. And you might say, well, how do you meditate, Kusala? How do you meditate, Kusala? I watch my breath. It goes out, it comes in, it goes out, it comes in. If it doesn't come in, I don't need to meditate anymore. It goes out, it comes in. And what's so cool about the breath? The breath always happens right now, in the present moment. You can't breathe yesterday. You can't breathe tomorrow. It's here now. Ram Dass, Be Here Now, great book. I liked Ram Dass. I saw him twice when he was alive. And he was the best speaker. And I said to myself, I want to be a speaker like Ram Dass. Because he always makes himself the butt of the joke. He doesn't blame other people, he blames himself. And this life of ours is about us and what we do. And you can't blame anybody else for making your life worse, because you made it worse in the way you reacted or responded. So here you are sitting quietly, 20 minutes, 45 minutes, day after day, week after week, month after month. It gets really boring, because nothing happens. You're sitting there waiting for something to happen, and nothing happens. And then you get up, get your cup of coffee, start your day, and the next day you go back and sit down, and nothing happens. And nothing happens. Okay, but what was happening is you were practicing letting go. You were practicing not clinging to ideas and material items. And in that moment, in your last moment on this earth, you're going to have to let go of everything forever. That's tough if you haven't practiced. That's really hard. So Buddhism not only makes every day a better day, but it makes the end a better end as well. Now, so what have I found being a Buddhist in America? I'm always different. You know, when I dress like this, you never belong except at the monastery where everybody else dressed like this. So how does it feel not to belong? How do you adjust to that? And when you start talking philosophically or religiously, you're different. You're going to be different. People want to have a soul. People want to go someplace when they die. They just don't want to have to let go. They want to go to heaven. Well, we have heaven in Buddhism, and we have hell in Buddhism, and we got all those places. The problem is, all our heavens and hells are temporary. Sometimes a really long temporary, but still they're temporary. So what does a Buddhist want to do? A Buddhist wants to achieve and realize nirvana. Ooh, I know it used to be a musical group as well. But nirvana, the end of suffering, the end of karma, and the end of all future rebirths. So right now, the Buddha is in nirvana. What does that mean? I have no clue. They don't get into it. They don't even reference it. There's just nirvana and parinirvana, nirvana after death. And I thought to myself, well, we have a little fish pond in the back of our meditation center, and we have fish, and for a while, we had turtles as well. And I imagine the turtle sitting on the rock, sunning himself, and the fish would come over and ask him, what's it like to be on the rock? What's it like to be out of the pond? What's it like to have air instead of water? And even if the turtle could tell the fish what it was like, the fish has no reference points. It wouldn't understand. And that's how I view nirvana. Even if the Buddha was to tell us what it is, we wouldn't get it, because we've never experienced anything like it. It's a rare place to be and hard to get to. How long does it take to get to nirvana? Lifetimes. Lifetimes. In each lifetime you're born, you're going to suffer, and you got to die again, and then you're born, and you suffer, and you die again. And so you want nirvana to end your suffering, except if you're Mahayana, which I'm part of the Mahayana tradition, which is a later tradition, the Theravada, early Buddhism, those are the Catholics. In Mahayana, we're the Protestants. And so we've changed the end game a little bit. What we've said is, no, we're not going to take nirvana. Even if we're almost there, we're going to postpone it because we want to be bodhisattvas. We want to help everybody end their suffering before we end our suffering. And they're out there. And there are a lot of Buddhists out there helping people who are suffering and postponing their own liberation for the good of others. Now, that takes a lot of practice to figure out that that's the right thing to do. Because we're so self-oriented, even though there's no self, that the other seems distant and maybe not as relevant as they should be. But you look at the world and you look at how many people are suffering. And then you look at all the people who are out there in the world helping suffering to be ended. And you can look at Gaza or Ukraine, and there are so many nonprofits out there with volunteers going in the face of war and armies to help the suffering and encourage them to continue. Blows my mind that these people, maybe not even with a religion, have decided to be of service in the most unusual way, putting their life in danger to help others. So being a Buddhist requires you to look at the world in a different way, I think, and requires you to look at yourself in a different way, I think, and eventually come to the place where, well, I don't really exist in the way I think I do, so it's more important for me to do something than to be something. I think we got it. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks for the invitation to speak.